Good morning.
Good morning.
I want you to be excited because I am really excited about this project. I had the opportunity to serve as the project officer for this outstanding project focused on testing strategies for African American MSM. And I'm going to be speaking about examining strategies for identifying and testing at-risk African American MSM who are unaware of their status. This presentation specifically is going to focus on the lessons learned and future directions. I'm Donna McCree. I'm the Associate Director for Health Equity in the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at CDC. At the time that this study was done, I was in the Prevention Research Branch, and the study was done there. I am so happy to acknowledge my colleagues. They're not on this slide because I have a huge slide at the end, and also because some are in the audience, I ask that you please raise your hand if you happen to be there. Thank you so much for your support. So glad to see you. Okay, so of course, I have no relationships to disclose. Now, moving on. Give you just a slight overview of the presentation. I'm going to do a very brief background, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the epidemiology of HIV infection among MSM, of course, because this project is focused on African American MSM. I'm going to focus on that that population. Then to give you a little bit of an overview of the project, we have a very good public poster presentation from one of our sites. I'd encourage you to see that as well. And then get to the meat of the discussion, which will be about the lessons that we learned, some future directions, and then I have just some brief closing remarks. So you know these data. According to our statistics, at the end of 2006, there were a little over a million people that were living with HIV in the United States. And our most recent surveillance report, which is from 2008, showed there were 421,269 persons diagnosed with HIV. And this time when we did our surveillance report, that's HIV at any stage of diagnosis, so it's new. And that's in the states with long-term confidential name-based HIV infection reporting. If we were to look at those data by transmission category, of course, MSM accounted for a greater proportion of the estimated new infections. And if we look at it by race, ethnicity, that would be African Americans. Now, this slide shows you diagnosis of HIV infection among adolescent males. This is between 2005 and 2008. This is 37 states along with the five U.S.-dependent areas. And what you see is that of those diagnoses, 74%, almost three-quarter, were in males. And by risk category, 70% of the diagnosed infections were attributed to male-to-male sexual contact. And then I want to really highlight that last sentence. In 2008, 54% of HIV infections that were diagnosed among adults and adolescents were attributable to male-male sexual contact. I included this slide because I wanted you to see the diagnosis by race, ethnicity. Again, this is in our 37 states with the mature long-term confidential name reporting in our five U.S. dependent categories. If we look by race, ethnicity, we see that 63% was among African American, black African Americans, which is how the census data are identify the population. 18% were among those identifying as white. Then if you look at this slide, I wanted to show you side by side the percentage of the population that was male compared to the diagnosis. Again, these are 2008 data. In 37 states, and you see 46% of the diagnosis was among black African American men. If we look at the male population in those 37 states within that race ethnicity, it was only 13%. This slide speaks to the disproportionate burden there. And this slide is really about adults and adolescents that were living with the diagnosis of HIV infection. Again, this is year-end 2007 data in the 37 states and the five U.S.-dependent areas. If you look down, we see among whites 128,334. So that's actually the largest percentage in terms of persons living with an HIV/AIDS diagnosis. Now, very interesting data, a way of reporting risk, and this was done in a paper by Irene Hall et al. And also, I'm quoting from a new MMWR that was released for National Latino AIDS Awareness Day, and it looks at lifetime risk of an HIV diagnosis. If we look among black African American males, it's 1 in 16. If we look among Hispanic Latino males, 1 in 36, and among white males, 1 in 102. So given these data, What did we do? We wanted to look also at some of the contributing factors, because I think it's important that you not just give the data without talking about what's actually going on. In terms of contributing factors, we know that according to a paper that was published by Millett et al., I think it was a couple of years ago in AJPH, it's really not about the risk behavior. There are some other things going on, mostly socioeconomic factors. Also, the background prevalence of STIs in African American communities is higher, so the chances of encountering a partner is higher, even given lower risk behavior. Things like access to care, poverty, and how does that affect an individual's risk? Well, we know that 1 in 4 African Americans actually live in poverty. That speaks to your wealth. That speaks to your ability to get health care. That also speaks to your networks. You tend to travel in networks that are very similar. If you talk about educational background, it speaks to that as well. Where you live, it speaks to that as well. Things like discrimination, racism, stigma, all of that can prevent an individual from actually going in to be tested, can prevent an individual from seeking care. I already spoke to the lower educational attainment piece. Additional factors, lack of awareness. We do know that there's sexual and physical violence within the community. Some data have shown that a large majority of African American MSM have been exposed or have a history of childhood sexual abuse. We do know about the risky partner type factors, where we have younger populations perhaps interacting with older men. And then competing priorities, if you're unstably housed, if there are other issues going on, then where does HIV fit in terms of your basic needs? And then around substance use as well. So given these contributing factors and also given the rates that I've talked about, what did we do? We funded the African American MSM Testing Project. And this project was funded to look at the relative effectiveness and the cost effectiveness of three strategies: alternate venue testing, the social network strategy, and at the time that this project was funded, it was called PCRS. Now it's known as Partner Services. And we were looking at these, evaluating these strategies, I should say, on their ability to reach and motivate previously undiagnosed 18 to 64-year-old African-American MSM to be tested for HIV and then linked to medical care and preventive services. We funded 4 sites in Atlanta, Baltimore, D.C., New York, 3 community-based organizations, and 1 health department. Again, we're looking at numbers, number tested. We did a very brief risk assessment, new cases identified, number linked to care and cost. There were some common eligibility requirements across the sites, although the sites had their own individual as well. For example, some of the sites allowed persons who identified as transgender to be a part of the testing group. And of course, no one was refused testing at those sites. But in order to be a part of this study, which was research evaluation, they had to meet our eligibility criteria. We tested between May 2008 and August 2010. I want to say a little bit about the sites. APT Associates partnered with us, helping us. That's our DC metropolitan area site. That's a community-based organization that specifically targets African American MSM. And then our site in Atlanta, AIDS Resource Consortium of Atlanta. Our site out of Baltimore was the City of Baltimore Health Department. They partnered with Johns Hopkins Medical. And then Harlem United Community AIDS Center, which is a community-based organization in partnership with NYU and specifically CHIPS. So each site had to have an ABT program in order to be eligible. We asked that they expand that program specifically to target African American MSM. 2 of the sites had on-site PCRS programs, the others did not. So for our evaluation purposes, we looked at aggregate data from the local health department around testing for the same population, same period. All of the sites were required to implement the social network strategy. That's what's exciting about this project. It's new. If you're aware of the Kimbrough et al. Publication that was published in November 2009, AJPH, from their demonstration projects that talked about the social network strategy. We provided training at CDC, and because this was a research study, they were subject to human subjects approval. Now, the social network strategy, as I said, is the exciting piece about this project. What did we do? Well, we asked HIV-positive and high-risk negative persons who were known as recruiters to identify and bring in persons from their social, sexual, and needle-sharing networks. This is different from PCRS because, as you know, under partner services, you bring in your sexual and needle sharing network. Now we're trying to get at high-risk networks, social networks. So we're asking individuals to bring in members of their social networks. And then the network associates were referred by their recruiters to a counseling and testing site. And then the network and associates and the recruiters were linked in our system. And the poster presentation that I talked about this afternoon is going to talk about APPS particular site, and they had a very, very elaborate system of linking the network associates and the recruiters. It was incentivized, and men who were found to be infected or at high risk for infection were referred to the appropriate medical care and preventive services. Now, this slide just gives you a little bit of our numbers. We just wrapped up our testing. We just finished cleaning our database, I'm happy to say. And I did not include the Baltimore data here because the health department had a sort of a different strategy. You know, they were under different requirements by law. So these are numbers from the other three sites, and these are combined numbers. If we look across, you see that there are a total of about 1,413 men were tested. The largest majority were tested through the alternate venue testing method, so we're reading our percentages for that across. But if we look down to the row of newly identified positives, what do we see here? 47 of the 325 who were tested through the social network strategy were newly identified positive. That's 15%. We look at our alternate venue testing piece, 57 out of the 913, which is 6%. And other, that category really is only from our app site because they were partnering with an organization that specifically targeted African-American MSM. Clients could walk into that Us Helping Us and become a part of the study if they were screened and eligible. We do have a method for assigning those men to a particular strategy after we've gone back to look at the data. But for now, they're categorized in our other category. Some of those men were previous positives. You see about 80% of the men who came in through our social networks piece were listed as high-risk negative. And then the other results along the bottom were indeterminate test results that we had across some of the sites. Now, this slide sort of breaks down our results by site. And again, what I wanted you to see here with these numbers in our social networks piece, we have not conducted any statistical analysis on these. These are just our raw numbers. Now, these are the data from Baltimore. And the reason it's on a separate slide is their recruitment strategy was different. So they actually tested all of their men through alternate venue testing. And then they recruited some men from their clinics. Those men who were recruited from their clinics could serve as seeds for our social network program. Everyone who tested newly positive were either assigned to a social network strategy or PCRS. It was every other, and that's because the health department was required to offer PCRS to all persons who tested positively. So this was our way of sticking to their standard of care, but still integrating social network strategy into a health department setting. So you see for them, the total number of new positives from the 414 that they tested through ABT was about 4.6%. And really what I wanted to highlight for you is the lessons that we learned. First of all, the social network strategy requires a very detailed plan and dedicated staff. The best case scenario would be have one main staff person assigned to oversee the social network strategy only. That's how labor intensive it is. It should be developed with input from your clients and your staff, and it would work best if it's tailored to your particular testing program. Also, training was required. We did an initial set of training, and you know that's sort of the new, here's what we're doing, here's how you do it. I think people flew to Atlanta for about 3 days, if I'm correct. But then that's really a didactic session. When you get back, you actually have to put it into practice. So then we found after, you know, going back and having them do it, we really needed to do some booster sessions. And then think now, these coaches, and we had staff that were coaching men to bring in their social networks. Yeah, what if the men didn't want to disclose to their social network person that they were positive? Or what if, you know, so you're trying, it's sort of a game here of trying to get people to come in to be tested. And that requires skills. So that's where the coaching sessions were very important. And you did have, we had to do modifications. And we found that there might be several modifications before you reach success. And it was very important that you had a staff that could establish good rapport with your recruiters and maintain consistent contact with those persons. Also, we did find that the use of incentives was very helpful. And the incentives had to be adequate by their community standards. For example, our New York site was competing with several other studies that were going on in the area. So while maybe our Atlanta site could offer a $10 voucher, that wasn't going to work with folk in New York. So we had to modify it to fit the particular program. It's also important, and this is where Us Helping Us was so successful, to select your ABT sites, including your days and times, with input from your site and your target population. They hit the ground running because they had already been focusing on African-American MSM in, you know, before this study began. And so they were able to get started, and they had their sites, and they were able to work through the process. And, of course, your staff should include members of the target population. And what we found was that a combination of strategies might be the best approach, as long as they're agency-specific and they target your population. So our future directions, we are hard at writing those outcome papers because you know how CDC is about those outcome papers. As soon as your data are collected, we need to see an outcome paper. So that's what we're doing now. We also had a very short section around risk behaviors. We're going to look at those. And we've submitted, let me go back, we have submitted a concept proposal for an MMWR. We do not know if that's going to be accepted. We also did a cost analysis at two of the sites. Those were the two sites that had the on-site PCRS, and we will be looking at those cost data as well. Just some brief closing remarks. Our data suggests, again, we did not do any statistical testing as of yet, but that while the social network strategy tested fewer men, but they yielded more new positives. Very labor intensive, but you're getting more new positives. And the CBOs that specifically targeted African American MSM, they were more successful according to our numbers at reaching those men. And what's really exciting is that three of the sites now have integrated the social network strategy into their counseling and testing program. Our New York site received additional funding from their local health department to adapt this program and expand it to reach young African American MSM. They came and did a very exciting trip presentation on their KISS project, which is that adaptation for young African American MSM. And our future studies, we think, should focus on the best combination of strategies to test men and link them to care and treatment. And again, I want to acknowledge this huge group of individuals who helped us with this project. I'm very excited about the results and what it means in terms of testing for African American MSM. And of course, we all have to include that nice little slide that says the findings and conclusions are the presentation of the authors and don't necessarily reflect the views of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'd like to thank you as well as all of our sites. Thank you.
That was great. Thank you all very much. We have time for some questions. Yes?
My question is specifically for Ms. Rao. Ms. McRae made a great case presenting the epidemiology and the data that young African-American men who have sex with men are at particular risk, that 85% of the adolescents being diagnosed with HIV are young black MSM. Yet, the Youth Risk Behavior Survey doesn't ask about that very critical demographic variable. So I suggest next time you do your presentation, please add that to the list of limitations because it's a very important one.
Yeah, it doesn't add that one.
Mm-hmm. In the back, on, go ahead, in the back.
I've heard John Ellen at Baltimore City Health Department say that the main difference is that it's incentivized. You are asking, and with respondent-driven sampling, to have individuals, these are usually hidden populations that you really can't get out, whether it's a study or testing, to identify folk in their network. The only difference is here we provided incentives for individuals to find those persons, and it included not just your social network, but also your sexual network and your drug using network. That's the only difference.
Okay. Yeah.
So that was actually the first part of my question. The second part was, I was wondering if you collected serum samples from those patients that were seronegative and perhaps seroconverting at the time.
I have to ask, you're talking for me? For the testing project, right?
No, my question is just tied into what they're asking, so I talked maybe.
Oh, did we collect?
So I wanted to find out how you determine the network size. Well, I thought it's tied into what they're asking.
Let me address her first. Now, your question again, could you repeat that?
No problem. I was wondering, first of all, do you do rapid testing?
All of the sites did rapid testing except one. The health department did not do rapid testing.
What kind of testing did you do?
They did standard testing.
Okay. And then I was wondering, for your negative, did you collect a serum sample to perhaps, you know, sort of do some pool testing, you know, to identify the risk of having seroconverting at the time?
Whatever their standard of care was at the time of however they did the testing, that's what they did. But in terms for this particular study, that was not something that we looked at.
And then, you know, the last thing was, you mentioned in your presentation that, you were talking about level awareness in those past 30, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what your thoughts were, because, you know, it is sort of known, or it's been written, that minority actually has a greater percent of testing, right? Mm-hmm. We actually test more often. So what should you mean by level awareness?
I actually wasn't talking about testing. I was talking about some of the contributing factors to the rates of HIV within the population. That's what I was speaking to. And if you look at the data, and I refer you to some of Paula Braverman's work, where she talks about the association between awareness, low educational attainment, poverty, all of that, and that if you are in a lower socioeconomic status, or if you're, let's say, for example, an adolescent in a school where that type of information is not provided to you, you have lower awareness of HIV in general, and that might be a contributing factor to what's going on. Is that the connection I was trying to make?
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Again, to you as a testing project, let us know, what are your thoughts on the feasibility, if you were able to, the project were able to identify a high percentage of new positives, than normally would have occurred in traditional testing. So I'm wondering, what is, I guess, the feasibility of the, like, standardizing this in testing without incentives? Like, how is this, do you see this becoming a widespread strategy without incentives, since it has to vary, and a lot of departments, health departments, or community-based organizations don't necessarily have the resources
right.
to offer incentives for this kind of testing strategy?
Well, and I can ask if you want to address that, Sandy or Scott or Sean from some of our other programs. But some of the sites are doing the social network strategy, and some of the sites also provide incentives for their alternate venue testing as well. Some do, as small as a token or a $5 gift card. So that's sort of their standard. And we have had some organizations who have actually implemented the social network strategy without incentives. I don't know those data that was done at some of the other projects, but that's something, if you give me a card, I'll follow up with you, give you some more information about that. And then I can ask Sandy or Sean.
One thing that I noticed is that I think it's critical a little bit better when you have incentives,
right.
when you have the right person in the job.
Right.
It really, really has to be the right person who has the ability to kind of establish rapport, talk with people, mm-hmm. and really establish trust with them. So I think the first thing when we did it, we did not have any incentives, and
right.
we just got nobody.
Right.
And
you should say you're in New York, where you were competing with
yeah,
these $50
studies. The CDC's behavior survey, mm-hmm. as well as other nonprofits that are giving $20. Like, why should I test for people? They're going to give me $20. So we, with social networks, it wasn't, we had an outreach person doing the SMS commitment. It wasn't quite the right mix. We had to get the right person who was actually doing that.
And some have done it. I'm sorry, Scott. Some have done it. I will follow up with you on that. I know that there are some health departments that have done it.
Another thing, though, I want to add is it was stressed in the presentation, and I think it is an important point to say that labor-intensive change, but on the other hand, after you have trained, it's really a diversion for most community-based organizations of training people who do outreach to do a different type of outreach. So I think after the initial training and getting people who are enthusiastic about engaging and doing this, it's not necessarily, oh, now I have to have another outreach worker that I have to do full-time to do this. In fact, it's another type of outreach. You're just training people to do something different. So it is very, I think, sustainable, given many community-based organizations are already using people that are doing outreach. So that's one advantage. Now, it doesn't address your question about incentives, but with regard to things, sustainability with regard to staffing, I think it can be used. And that's what's happened in Us Helping Us, that they are using one of their outreach persons now dedicated to this.
All right, this gentleman up front.
Yes.
Can you stand, sir, could you stand up so they can hear in the back?
Okay. Yes, I'm just wondering about the network size, how you determine the person, MSM, select another person, what about another person? So how did you determine what was the major challenge in estimating the size of the network?
Oh, no, we had some limitations on how many people they could bring in, and that was because this was a research study, so we had to go with our IRB protocol. And most of the sites, it was up to six, correct, that you could bring in out of your network? It varied. I think the largest number I saw was up to six, and then that was for one particular recruiter. And then, of course, that network, one of the network associates could also become a recruiter in the future, and you could do that. We have not done any network analysis yet to actually look at it. I don't know if your poster's going to be talking about that. Is it Shomp at all? Or?
Yeah, we didn't do network analysis, mm-hmm. but we do show how we were trying to penetrate the network.
Right.
Instead, to have network associates become recruiters is really key, because you're really trying to get at those individuals that you may not have gotten at before through, through other testing methods.
And it's important to note, too, that, you know, you could find within your network that the it doesn't include just men. It could be women, you know, as well as in the network. So I think we'll find some exciting findings when we look at who are networking now.
Go ahead. Yeah, she's been waiting, so go ahead. Could you stand up, please?
For the newly identified positives, what was the linkage to care, pace of the referral follow-up for them if finances were limited?
Well, each of the organizations provided that anyway. It was a requirement to be funded that you had a service in place to link positives. And it varied by the sites. Of course, the health department did what they normally would do, Us Helping Us as well, Harlem United. All of them had, at various ARCA, had standard programs for linking individuals to care. And it was a part of our intake form as well.
Yes.
I'd like to thank you, ma'am. I'd like to give you a chance to sit down, though, and I'm going to ask for some questions. And thank you all for your presentations. I thought they were great. Rasan, you were talking about the calls that come in, especially on the weekends and all of that. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the nature of the calls, maybe the intensity of the calls mm-hmm. that your staff has to deal with? Mm-hmm. Is it kind of emotional? Are these longer?
It's extremely emotional. It's situation-based, you know.
Yeah.
Our callers feel a certain amount of confidentiality and privacy speaking to someone, you know, a couple thousand miles away that they don't even know. So it's, and that's, you know, I mentioned about the diagnosis. A lot of callers want a diagnosis. They want to know, do they have it? And we can't provide that diagnosis. So what we do is we listen to their situation and then we just provide them with the basic content that DHAP has given us. Which, you know, come in the form of a lot of PRs.
So they tend to be longer calls than what you typically
Yeah, I mean, they go from, you know, they'll go from an STD to HIV, you know. There's definitely multi-topic, depending on the situation and things like that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question first? And I'll show you my age and how long I've been. Is this replace the National AIDS Hotline? CDC info is
yes.
now okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'll show you how old I am. Okay. So.
I'm old.
Yep. Yeah. In the middle, right there.
Hi. I was wondering how these projects would be contributing to the National HIV AIDS strategy, or what impact they'll have. I know in talking about coordinating better the SAMHSA substance abuse, where it might be coming in. But if you could just talk a little bit more about that.
Do you want all of us to address that, or
whoever feels the need?
Well, I'll start. And I'm only going to do that because I just became the Associate Director for Health Equity at the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention. And our office will be responsible for monitoring the division's efforts around the national strategy. So whatever we're doing to address the key strategies that were assigned to CDC within that strategy, agencies, and our office will be monitoring that. And that the strategy identified populations that were disproportionately impacted: African Americans, Latinos, NSM, injection drug users, transgender persons, incarcerated populations. We will have coordinators that will focus on those particular populations. And the research that's being done, we will also use that to feed back to our programs to make sure that our programs are meeting the needs and are doing what the strategy has identified. So I can say that at least is what we're doing. So the testing project sits right in because we're identifying new infections. And you know the goal is to decrease incidence and to improve equity. So that's what this project is focused on.
Anybody else want to address that? Or?
Well, the data I use for this study came from SAMHSA. And both CDC and SAMHSA have been working and making sure that the substance abuse treatment providers offer HIV prevention services, including HIV testing, either as providing guidelines for HIV testing in case of CDC, for example, or SAMHSA funding HIV testing, as well as providing money for rapid HIV testing services and substance abuse treatment. All are coordinated efforts, and eventually they will contribute to, we hope they will contribute to the reduction of HIV prevalence, HIV incidence among populations that are targeted as high risk or identified as high risk population. So there is already a coordinated effort in terms of funding from CDC. That depends, that comes through health departments, and we don't know how much of that funding goes down to HIV substance abuse treatment providers, but overall there is a coordinated effort, at least from Department of Health and Human Services.
Could you stand up in the back?
I just had a question again about the CDC. Do you have data on how far-reaching it is? How many cities have found it? Any geographic?
Yes, we have a lot of geographic information. What we do is in our service requests, where we log in the call and the resolution, we have data that we can get their zip code, and we can use that for future studies.
Do you have a sense of the data that you showed, if it was like predominantly from one area or another, any sort of geographic area?
Well, the data I showed, I didn't really look into the location, but we could do that.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Ma'am.
Yeah.
Could you stand up, please, so they can hear you in the back?
For Ms. Rao, I know you were talking about the YRR data. There are some contributing factors that are left out of the YRR data, whether it's the behavioral risk factors or the resiliency testing. I think something that I think we need to look at is adding those contributing factors into the YRRS data, because NAFLA does the NAFLA specific YRRS data. So I think some of the contributing factors that need to be included are the sexual orientation, the history of sexual violence, and the because it's hard to understand the LGBT community within your own community if you don't have that capacity to do so. And I know it's going to hit a stone wall against our IRBs, but you know, that's just something that we need to look at, because the HIV community has to look at, address that issue at this time. So that was just something else that...
Actually, they are addressing, they are trying to revise the YRBS questionnaire coming from 2012. So, I mean, there might be some changes. There's a potential to add in more questions or to keeping up with the HIV epidemic to make sure, and also related to adolescents, to add in few more questions that targets and gives us a better idea of how the epidemic is progressing among adolescents.
Yeah, there's so there a lot of schools that take home. You only have that 45 minutes of time to ask certain questions.
Yeah.
So I was just asking.
Yeah, so the way it's reworded or the way it's like sounded, they are planning to change the 2012.
Yes.
Thank you. Just another quick comment about the last presenter.
Mm-hmm.
I was just asking, I'm really interested in social networks. I'm from Chicago, I'm writing, and I just wrote a small grant. I'm interested in looking at an aspect of social networks. But I asked if you guys had looked into the different categories of Latinos in front of Latino group, and she was mentioning you guys just asked Hispanic and Latinx.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true for all the sites?
for, are you talking about for the this project?
Yeah, is that true for all the sites? You only requested whether they were Hispanic or not versus like were they Mexican, Puerto Rican?
Well, actually, this project was focused only on African American MSM. Yeah, so.
So if you got somebody.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just eligibility.
Do you have any plans for something similar to that? Are you going to further become a Latino?
Yeah, and we are looking at those initiatives. As I just said, this new office, which I'm still talking about, we will have a Latino focus as well. And as you know, we just increased our funding for HIV testing. I forget the funding and opportunity announcement number. It ended originally in 2010, but was extended for 3 years. HIV testing initiative specifically to focus on Hispanic Latino populations and working with community-based organizations. If I can remember that funding announcement, I'll share it with you, but it's already been done, it's already out there. Those organizations have been funded and the HIV testing is ongoing.
Just, you know,
because
you probably know, like, whatever it's funded, you know, the Puerto Rican community, mm-hmm. the HIV that I'm doing, the Mexican Puerto Rican community, for example, they're very different. They're just like the Black Lives Care.
Yeah. It is, and one of the things we found in our group, which we, and Scott and Shanza and Sandy can tell you, we talked for days about African-American population is not monolithic either. And we used Black African-American because that's what the census data uses. So, I mean, then we had to decide, what about populations in New York who were of Caribbean descent?
Right.
You know, what do we do there? So we had questions back and forth, and you're right, it's an ongoing effort that we all need to address. And these types of projects allow us to do that and to improve what we're doing. So thank you, and I will take that back, and yes, we are focusing on it.
Can I ask one, when you say social networks, I'm just questioning, because we're having a big issue in our community, that means also the electronic networks that they're part of, the chat rooms,
they would have to identify, the person would have to come in.
Okay,
have
gotcha.
To know who that person is, and that person would have to come in. You could call them whatever you wanted to call them when they got there.
Right.
They didn't have to use their real name. But if it's an anonymous type of link up, I don't know how we could
okay.
call them.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Could you stand up, please, so they can hear you?
Okay. My question is toward Dr. Rowe, right? In the Gazette, if I understood correctly, white adolescents reported more substance abuse, but less testing than African-American participants in the study. So I'm curious about, like, using white adolescents as a reference group when they had more substance abuse but less testing, and then what are the thoughts on how your work will move forward in looking at those kinds of studies, because obviously there's a lot of focus on African-American adolescents getting tested and risk behaviors, but if there's a clear indication that there's a huge amount of risk factors or risk going on in white adolescents, how is that not being discussed or addressed?
Actually, in the future analysis, we are trying to adjust for that as well. Because this basically the first part was just to show among the substance users who were the people, I mean, what was the distribution of our sampling. And later we tried to do the adjusted odds ratio to figure out the who were more prone for testing among the subpopulations. But in the future paper as well, we are planning to adjust for those work group, adjust for those behaviors as well.
Okay.
So is there any indication that there's a large percentage of, or a percentage of unidentified positives in white adolescent community because they're not getting tested but have higher risk factors, but we're always talking about the percentage of African American adolescents who are positive. Like, is there any kind of conversation around that happening?
Yeah, that's something to, of course, there's a correlation there. That's something to consider.
Are there any more questions? I think they'll be here for a few minutes afterwards if you need to talk individually. I also want to remind you all the HIV section meeting is tomorrow night at 6:30 in CCC room 701. Hope you'll have a chance to come by and participate in that as well. Again, thank you for coming out in early morning, no matter what time your body clock is on. So thank you very much.